Well, this issue of Audio Arts called Locations and Strategies starts here in London at the Institute of Contemporary Arts, where the Right Honourable Neil Kinnock, MP, is about to open the William Morris exhibition.
May I first of all address the minority and say, ladies and gentlemen, and the majority and say, comrades. It was a considerable honour to be asked here. Well, there's somebody booed there, part of a dying race. to be asked to come here this evening and to open the exhibition. Though I'm very glad to say that already several hundred people have been admitted. And just for the slight taste that I was able to get as I went around, obviously that all who pass through this exhibition will have an enormous experience of seeing a continuity, a relevance, a relationship with the crises and struggles and difficulties and indeed the hopes that we have now, and be able to possibly learn and model their answers on what William Morris showed and taught. Now, I've got some words that I put together, and I actually am going to read them. It's a little strange, but I'm starting to have to read speeches and few words now that I'm leader of the Labour Party, and it's my turn this year. And that's in order that the record be accurate, and indeed, so they tell me, that the speech be brief. So for reasons of accuracy and brevity, I'd just like to pass on these few words in order to try and convey to you what William Morris has meant for many years to me and what I hope he means to you and what I hope he will continue to mean for many more who have yet to have the excitement of encountering what I call Morrisism. Memories of William Morris have been obscured by a cloud of legend and misunderstanding, a great deal of it calculated deliberately to distort his work, to diminish his reputation, and to conceal the real meaning of his life and his teaching. Sometimes we are told that he was a great-hearted, impractical artist who only became a socialist by accident. Sometimes we are told that he was a sentimental socialist, pining for the Middle Ages. Other times we are told that he was, although the people who say this were politically illiterate, an anarchist. And there are even those who now would scorn Morris as utopian, whilst themselves telling the fairy tale that in some trade union-free, denationalised, tax-free, fully armed day, a mystical conjunction of demand and supply will somehow produce peace and plenty and perfection for the whole world. Who really are the utopians? Those who believe that load of bloody nonsense, or those who follow the teaching of William Morris. The fact about Morris is that his reaction to industrialism was based on a real understanding, illustrated very directly in this exhibition, of the corrosive effects of capitalism. He was not a machine breaker longing for a return to archaic values and archaic methods. In his age, as in ours, it was the regressives in politics and in society who sought to mobilize nostalgia. The progressives, as in our age, and this includes all of us quite naturally, only recall the past in order to avoid reliving it. Morris's genius lay in his ability to carry theory into action. He felt that the artist should not simply be limited to abstract and sentimentalized spirituality, but should create works which, whilst with the grain of nature and aesthetically beautiful, were nevertheless functional. We rightly celebrate him, therefore, as an artist who was able to embody beauty in the implements and in the surroundings of everyday life. He wanted art not just for art's sake, but for fulfillment's sake, and he fiercely asserted his belief that all have the capacity to create beauty if society provides the opportunity for the enrichment of sensibility. The artist, he said, should become a labourer, and the labourer become an artist. Morris is often cruelly dismembered into component parts. The poet, the craftsman, the designer, the pamphleteer. In fact, he combined all of these elements because the core which unified all of his work, in my view, was his commitment to the socialist ideal. And one of the many virtues of this exhibition is that it reassembles Morris's attributes as a whole and shows how they are interrelated one to another, indeed interdependent one upon another. He realized that the arts were, amongst many other things, a sphere of political activity. "I don't want art for a few," he said, "any more than I want education for a few or freedom for a few." And that idea that universal emancipation of expression and from drudgery is essential to a just society and to a productive economy has inspired generations of socialists. And it means that we can employ Morrisism as a guide to our purposes and our policies a century later. His constant search was for a means to fill up this terrible gap between riches and poverty, and to put an end, as he said, to that fatal division of men, and I would assume that he meant women as well, into the cultivated and the degraded classes which competitive commerce has bred and fosters. That objective is still the essence of democratic socialism. Morris spent his life fighting ugliness. His affirmation of the values of beauty in substance and in spirit was an affirmation of humanity, a call for socialism. To Morris, beauty and humanity could not be fully realized in a society fractured and dominated by a market ethic which imposes an admission price even on joy. The new days of fellowship and rest and happiness, of which Morris wrote and for which he campaigned, need a different system. And we're still striving for that, equipped with Morris's work by hand and by brain, and inspired through his confident hope. "Yes, surely," he announced, "and if others can see it as I have seen it, then it may be called a vision rather than a dream." In 1937, the South Walian poet Idris Davies, a strong admirer of William Morris, was accomplishing the transition from being a coal miner to a trained teacher. He was an enemy of obscurity in poetry, just as Morris was, and in his poem written in 1937 to William Morris, he said, "Because the mind is growing old, a slave that bends to the god of gold, we have no time to earn your lay, sweet singer of an idle day. We have great problems and great pains and gas mask drills and aeroplanes. We would not understand your way, sweet singer of an idle day. We have no frenzy in the heart. We play a mean mechanic's part. You wouldn't understand our way, sweet singer of an idle day. We honor dolts in racing cars," and I'm not being personal about relation to the Prime Minister. We honor dolts in racing cars and dirty dogs and talky stars. Our fields are brown, our children grey, O singer of an idle day." Of the least idle of all human beings, Morris was the great celebrator of productive days. But production and commitment and activity in a way that would fulfill people, that would make them in the very act of creativity feel that they were doing what they enjoyed doing best. And when they enjoyed doing best, they produced of their best. They related to other people of their best. They made a better society. We still work for that society, and we are grateful to William Morris for being an inspiration of that purpose.
Well, that was Neil Kinnock talking on the occasion of the opening of the William Morris exhibition here in London at the ICA. The next item has also a link with the ICA. It's a conversation with Declan McGonigal, who was at the time of the interview director of the Orchard Gallery in Londonderry, but now is exhibitions director at the Institute of Contemporary Arts. So the next item is a conversation with Declan driving around Derry. So now we're in fact, out of Orchard Street and approaching... Is this...
The building directly ahead of us is the Guildhall, which is the seat of local government here. And this is relevant because the Orchard Gallery is administered by the City Council. I'm an employee of the City Council, and the gallery is run by them with a grant from the Arts Council of Northern Ireland. And it's always been very important to me that the gallery should function here in this location, that it shouldn't operate as if it's in another location altogether. So I've always been very sensitive and very aware of the specific conditions here, the needs of the audience in a sense, the context out of which the idea of the gallery grew, because you have to remember that the Orchard Gallery is the first ever publicly funded art gallery in Derry, and therefore there was no municipal gallery, there's no museum in Derry, there's no art school in Derry, so there was no ready-made audience, there was no ready-made structures into which it could fall and possibly disappear. When I started work, I felt it was really important that the gallery should act as an inlet, not only into Derry, but into Northern Ireland and Ireland, of work that had not been seen here before. And I was very surprised to find that some significant artists who had in fact visited Ireland, used Ireland as part of the content of the work, had never been asked to show here in one-man shows. So I set about approaching those artists and asking would they show, and they all agreed.
Now, returning to the drive around, whereabouts in fact in relation to the various parts of Derry are we now?
Well, we have just come out of the city centre and we're more or less in the area that's known as the Bogside. It's actually an inaccurate title. It's the Bogside was the name of one street which was picked up by the media and is now a label for the whole area. But the specific area we're approaching now is Rosemount, and directly ahead is Rosemount Police Station. Heavily fortified Rosemount Police Station, which is manned by the RUC.
How have you related to the troubles, which have been pretty extreme at times, running a gallery of contemporary art? I mean, has there been any kind of direct overlap at all?
It hasn't impinged on the gallery's operations at all, and I think it's the reason for that is really due to the fact that I've tried to run the gallery in a way which showed people here that the gallery belongs to them, the gallery is for them, that they are the genuine audience for the gallery, and that therefore they trust the gallery. And there would be no, I think, no reason or no occasion when I could conceive of somebody trying to damage the gallery or stop things that they do. There has never been any casual vandalism in the gallery or around the gallery, which is something I was worried about, you know, the sort of casual throwaway vandalism that can happen anywhere, but it's never happened in the gallery or around it. And that seems to me, with hindsight, to see how important it was that that trust should be developed, because out of that trust develops an audience, and that seems to me the proper role of the gallery in this location. I think one of the reasons too that the gallery has gained a lot of trust, where you have people who would live in this area who would visit the gallery and feel close to it in some way, is that because of the activities we've done with young people, both in terms of the music events, concerts, the support for young persons' activities, and then a sort of range of personal things that I've been involved in outside the gallery operation.
Now we have a big wall here with a slogan saying it's Derry, not Londonderry, and a Republican flag on the top of it, and in fact plenty of Republican slogans and flags painted on the buildings here with RUC keep out. So where are we entering now?
This is Roswell Street. We're now approaching an area at the corner of Roswell Street and William Street, which is the traditional battlefield when any riot or incident develops. As you can see, the car park area here is a wide open space where you know you can have a traditional sort of almost a traditional battle formation of two lines of opposing armies in a sense facing each other. All the slogans and all they did really, there was always a sort of random graffiti that went on, but the slogans we just passed and the murals we passed, the mural projects we passed, all came about as a result of the hunger strike and the development of Sinn Féin as a sort of coherent political entity. It was as if the graffiti became tidy and concentrated and directed. And the reference to Derry, not Londonderry, came about in the recent election because part of the debate here locally was about the City Council changing the name from Londonderry back to Derry, which was its traditional name from the Irish originally. And at the end of this particular road we're on now is the beginning of the Letterkenny Road, which would take you to Donegal and to Letterkenny. And we could maybe go out there and just cross the border to show you how close it is to the city.
Well, as we're now going to drive for a few miles out of Derry toward the border, perhaps we could, you know, go back to talking about the gallery. Now, I think there's certainly something to be said about the particular way in which you approach making exhibitions with artists, which isn't simply, for instance, to see the gallery as the terminal point for an exhibition. I mean, you go beyond that,
yes,
don't you, in relation to how you approach showing work?
Oh, yes, I think it's very important. And when I talk about exhibitions, I talk about making an exhibition with an artist. I don't talk about giving an artist an exhibition or an artist having an exhibition. It's a joint effort. A good exhibition is one which gets the relationships between the specific works you show, the artist you invite to show, the location, and the actual gallery space right. Those are all elements in the equation that comes out finally as an exhibition. And in some cases, what might be as important as the objects in the space, if indeed they are objects, is the published material, printed material. You see, essentially, a gallery is just a device, an invention to bring people into contact with art. And if your starting point is the art the artist makes and the art that is around in the world, then it's very, very important that you have a very broad attitude to presenting that work. Your starting point should always be what the art demands by way of presentation, and it will not always be the four walls of the Orchard Gallery. And even when it is the four walls and floor of the Orchard Gallery, I believe that the gallery should be changed around each time. That, again, the starting point for operating within the space should be the nature of the work, the identity of the work. And you then provide, as a gallery operation, as a facilitator, which is how I see my job, we should provide what is required by the art. And that is the starting point for the work I do, really.
Now, you mentioned publications, and I mean, I know you've produced a very significant sequence of publications. I mean, you're saying, presumably, then, that you don't see a distinction necessarily between the concept of the publication and the concept of the exhibition you've made with the artist. I mean, it's not as though you're producing a kind of passive catalogue of the work.
Not at all. I emphasise the fact that the publications are not catalogues, and they should not be perceived as catalogues at all. They should be perceived, where we have set up a publication which operates like this, of course, as the artist's works, as valid expressions or vehicles for the artist's ideas as objects in the space. And particularly now in the 80s, when there is a large number of artists who are working with non-object art, in a sense, working with ideas, publications are sometimes the most efficient means of bringing those ideas to the public. In fact, we're just approaching the army checkpoint now.
Right, now this is an army checkpoint as we come to the border. Now, what will happen here, do you think?
Well, I'll just have to present my license to
right.
The soldier or policeman, and then the border is further on up the road.
Okay, so this is in fact the first appearance of military presence. Is it all right if I keep the tape recorder running, do you think?
Well, keep it running and see what happens.
Okay.
You might ask. We'll see. I'll get my license. Hi, Dan.
Hi, yes, sir.
Hi. We were just making a tape on the
He's
way
doing
up with this guy.
You and me?
No, with me.
With him.
Oh, sorry.
I run the Orchard Gallery, seeing he's doing an interview with that.
That's dead on.
Okay.
Ahead,
thanks.
Thank you.
Ciao.
Could you tell me something about the Icon?
It's very much thought of as a venue for artists, run by artists, initiated by artists, to show other artists and the general public their work.
In a sense, it was a self-help thing, in a way.
I think the gallery, even now, is very conscious of how... Well, I certainly am very conscious of how it was set up. That it was very much set up as an independent institution that was answerable to nobody but the people who actually set it up in the first place. And it's always valued that independence, and that now, in a way, seems very much a product of the sort of 1960s and the air of optimism and everything else about how galleries could be run, that they could exist independently, that they could show work that maybe nobody was interested in or nobody liked, but they valued the work and therefore they were able to show it.
Does that show itself in terms of a particularly strong connection with current art activity in the Birmingham area?
One of the criticisms of the gallery would be that it doesn't as much as it perhaps should do. I think what we are able to do by just being here, by providing a venue where people can come and see what's going on, we are doing that. We are supporting art that's happening in Birmingham. The attitude is that you don't make a special case for Birmingham artists. In some way, you're organising a programme of exhibitions that, at least in somebody's mind, is showing the best of contemporary work at the moment, or a version of the best of contemporary work at the moment. Now, if work that's being done in Birmingham happens to fit into that, that's marvellous, but you don't make special claims for work in Birmingham, I suppose. And I don't think actually artists would want that either. There's nothing more insulting to an artist than to say you're being shown because you're a local artist, not you're being shown because we value your work, whether you live in Birmingham or anywhere else.
The programme that you run is not, well, it certainly doesn't fight shy of recent developments or what some people might consider to be difficult work. Do you find that there is a lot more resistance to a Chris Burden performance or a Susan Hiller installation than to John Bell and his paintings, for example?
Well, if you're aware of that, if you're aware of the fact that people find some exhibitions easier than others, and the way that you can get them to look at the ones that they find difficult is by not giving them a constant diet of things that are difficult, then you're talking about programming. You're talking about quite deliberately and calculatedly organising a programme of exhibitions over a year where you'll get that kind of change of emphasis, change of colour in a programme that's absolutely audience orientated. It's about accessibility, really. It's about how do I make what I believe in as accessible as I possibly can to the public without compromising what I show. Now, that's all very well, but that's actually very difficult to reconcile with the needs of artists. And I do sometimes wonder that the balance has gone the other way. With all my concern for the public and feeling that if I'm doing anything here, I'm actually sharing what I get out of work with other people, or attempting to do that, and attempting to make that a source of leisure and enjoyment for as many people as possible, with making sure that the artists get what they want out of it as well. It's not impossible, and the crucial thing is the education programme, I think. What it mustn't be is some kind of compromise about my notions of quality, and it's only my notions because I'm the person who selects the exhibitions, and that's in a whole area of difficulty, obviously.
Do you have any opinions about the way in which other galleries, other regional galleries, are negotiating that problem?
The sort of support structure for younger artists, which has been undermined by things like lack of college teaching and all those financial problems, I have the impression is also being undermined by the failure of curators in galleries to take risks. And taking risks, in my terms, is seeing work which maybe you're not absolutely sure about, but you think there are interesting things going on and there are interesting things going to come out of it. And the way you might be able to actually help that and facilitate that would be to give an artist a chance to put that work up on the walls and to create some kind of dialogue, either with other artists or with the public and so on. And it's something to do with this business of independence again. There are very few now, and again, I might be imagining this, but I'm sure it's more so than it was a few years ago, really independent galleries. Galleries who've been successful in whatever terms you determine that success, have gained funding from things like the regional arts associations, the arts councils, even city councils and local authorities and so on. And maybe certain things are expected of you then. You are expected to be successful. And if you're expected to be successful in order to achieve the money that you need to keep going, you are less willing to take risks that might be failures. And I think that is the most exciting part of the job, for one thing, and it's the most important thing. And I think we don't take enough risks. And I think also we're still probably far too precious about what we do as well. Precious in terms of fine art being cut off from the rest of the world, which you could say then goes back to things like artist residencies and all those things. But it's not about that. It's about how you promote yourself. How do you expect to be able to compete with television and football matches and all those things if you're not in there with the rest of them struggling for the audience? And I don't feel that any of us quite get our hands dirty enough to want to make that kind of struggle, because it implies something about art which makes it more like other things, which you imagine are more kind of saleable or consumer orientated, like football or so. But it doesn't. I don't think it is that. I think it's the method. If you're good at selling what you do, then the benefit of the selling is actually making people see what you do. So it's not compromising the art. It's just compromising the way you might go about making people aware of it and coming to look at it and so on.
Wherever you are, we're near you. Painting, sculpture, installations, photography, video, performance. Whoever you are, we've something to offer you. Icon Gallery, close to the art of the country. At 5872 John Bright Street, Birmingham. 021-643-0708.
The Orchard Gallery in Derry presents exhibitions of contemporary art, installations, video, sculpture, painting, photo works and performance by Irish, British and international artists. Exhibitions are made in close collaboration with artists, and publications and other printed material are treated as extensions of the exhibition possibilities. The Orchard Gallery, Orchard Street, Londonderry. A space for contemporary art ideas.
Where can you go to see and hear tapes of the best in contemporary visual culture? Interviews with thinkers and doers. Joseph Boyce, John Berger, Stuart Brisley, Dennis Hopper, Melina Mercouri, Jermaine Greer, Julia Kristeva, Laurie Anderson. Original artist video from Europe and North America. Nam June Pike, Douglas Davis, Bill Viola, Sam Vaughan Fitzgerald, Dara Birnbaum. British and international independent film. Derek Jarman, Steve Dwoskin, Peter Greenaway, Bill Douglas, Werner Herzog, Wim Wenders, Fassbinder, Oshima, John Jost, Jean-Luc Godard. Documentaries on artists and isms. Edward Hopper, Eugene Atje, Gilbert and George, David Nash, David Hockney, pop, punk, rock and Dada. Constructivist, impressionist, surrealist or modernist. From the trans avant-garde to the transsexual, the ICA Videotheque is home to them all. The ICA Videotheque, open from noon till 5:30, Tuesday to Sunday. Open access viewing for only 50 pence per half hour at the ICA, The Mall, London, SW1.
I started the gallery in September 79 after quite a few visits to Poland to a gallery which is very similar to this in Poznan, run by Jarosław Kozlowski. And I knew I had a space which I could turn into a gallery, and a large space which in fact I wasn't actually using. And that the whole idea appealed to me, that shows could be put on a shoestring budget for short periods of time. And so I decided to do it myself, or try and do it in England. I never really expected the gallery to grow to the size it has grown. I really expected it to be quite a private affair. It's remained a private affair, but it has become quite well known, has a fairly good reputation, I believe, and that sometimes worries me because I've nearly joined the bureaucracy. But I think that's because of the hard work and professionalism and the types of shows that I've put on. It's the kind of professional attitude I've brought to the gallery, which I think is lacking in a lot of galleries in England and in the regions. I don't like the word alternative. I don't actually see mine as an alternative space. I see it as my space, my studio, which I offer to artists to use as their space to produce a piece of work. In most cases, the shows are made for the gallery. Recently, they've been coming from abroad, so it hasn't been possible to make them for the gallery. But just a place for them to make a piece of work, to be financed by the gallery, partly by me and partly by the Greater London Arts Association. I think that's another important thing about this gallery. Everything is paid for. Directors are quite often, understandably, too busy to actually give the artist showing at that particular time as much time as he or she needs, because they're thinking of the next show or the show after that. And artists can be, I think, quite often get a rough deal. Every time I put a show on, even though it's somebody else's show, I do some, to some degree it's a collaboration, I myself feel as excited or as psyched up as the artist, because I feel every time I do it, it's almost like having your own opening. I know that, you know, if anything goes wrong, it's down to me. I've no one else to blame. That's the other thing, because it's just run by me. My own work, both now or in the past, has always kind of used the public, often used the public to make works for me. And in a way, I don't see this to be that different, except I invite somebody to make a work in this space, and he or she gets on and makes it. And because I'm here all the time, and because I do see it as part of my own, say, creative output, I feel I have the right, if there's such a thing, to interfere. I do interfere, and sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. And I mean, that's also difficult for the artist, because artists do work in isolation and produce works in a studio and then take them to a gallery and exhibit them, whereas here that doesn't happen, which also in a way is a help to me, because it actually cuts out a whole lot of people that couldn't show here. You know, I mean, it's part of it. I've no interest in just paintings arriving, going on the wall, and that being the end of it. So there's this kind of dialogue between me and the artist, which I think to some degree is sometimes the most fruitful. You don't just find yourself at Matt's gallery. It's actually a conscious decision to go there. You're met at the door and you're led in. Even this specialised audience that come, who are supposedly informed on art, actually give the artist perhaps a longer viewing time. You can't just walk out. And if you don't like the work or it's a little difficult to understand, I think people actually stay here longer than in a public gallery where the doors open. So in the fact that I sort of feel I have a captive audience, this might be a bad way, but they are trapped once they're in there, in the space, because I have to let them out. We put on between 5 and 8 shows a year. Roughly it works out about 6. That's about every 2 months. Each show runs for a week, from Sunday to Sunday, which is long enough for this space. I mean, I actually think that a lot of other galleries could actually put more shows on if they didn't run for 3 to 4 weeks. I think they could get through more art. People who come to this space are in the habit, knowing that if they don't come within the first week, they've missed it, and that's it. And I think if you run for 3 weeks, I wouldn't get a much bigger audience, because people do tend to leave off going to shows until the last minute. Artists are lazy. Critics are even lazier. They're all my own selections on what I know, sometimes on recommendation. It's really a personal taste. I have tried to show shows from abroad as well, not as many as I would have liked to. Other people say I'm a conceptual gallery. I don't actually think I'm a conceptual gallery. I think I'm a gallery that shows thinking artists. You can afford to fail at maths. In fact, you can't fail at maths ever, because it really doesn't matter. But you can take that chance. You know when you show here, you're not going to show for commercial gain. I have no interest whatsoever in selling works. Although potentially, if anybody wants to buy anything, they can buy it. I'm not against selling, but it's a different game, which I know nothing about, nor do I want to get into. I miss the works when they leave this space, when they go away. I mean, I'm very lucky to have someone's work for a week up and another week afterwards, all to myself and my own space. It's like my living room. It's a very nice situation to be in. Perhaps I get quite uptight when I talk about this space, because I feel so attached to it.